Timothy Hansen was a man who approached the problems of life with a calm and measured tread. He prided himself that this habitual approach had brought him, in the prime of middle age, to the wealth and standing that he now enjoyed. That crisp April morning, when an old friend who had been his personal doctor for years said, "Had you been a different man, I might have been tempted to lie to you," Hansen had thanked him for his candor. Outside, Richards, the chauffeur, was standing by the rear of the Rolls, waiting. Hansen climbed in and relaxed in the interior warmth. "The office, Mr. Hansen?" Richards asked. No, Kent, said Hansen. The Silver Wraith had turned south, heading for the river, before Richards ventured a question. "Nothing wrong with the old tickers, sir?"
"No," said Hansen, "still pumping away."
But there was indeed nothing wrong with his heart. And this wasn't the time or the place to discuss with his chauffeur the mad, insatiable cells that were eating away at his bowel. 6 months must seem an age, he mused, if you've just been sentenced to prison. But when that's all that is left you, it doesn't look so long. Not so long at all. He was, he reminded himself, a man of no small substance. There was, for instance, his city dealership in rare and precious coins, wholly owned by him, with no partners and no shares. He thought with fondness of the lovely manor house in Kent to which he was heading, set in 20 acres of clipped parkland, and wondered what would happen to it. Then there was the large apartment in Mayfair. And apart from the business and the two properties, there was his private coin collection, and the portfolio of stocks and shares, not to mention the deposit accounts in various banks. At that moment, the car came to a stop at a pedestrian crossing in one of the poorer sections of the old Kent Road. Hansen looked out of the window. A crocodile of small children was crossing the road under the guidance of 4 nuns. At the end of the queue, a small boy had stopped in the middle of the crossing and was staring with undisguised interest at the Rolls-Royce. He had a round and pugnacious face with a snub nose. His tousled hair was surmounted by a cap set askew with the words St. Benedict's on it. When he caught sight of the distinguished silver head behind the tinted window, without hesitation he placed the thumb of his right hand to his nose and waggled the remaining fingers in defiance. Without a change of expression, Timothy Hansen made an identical gesture back at the boy, who grinned from ear to ear. But in a second he was whisked off the crossing by a flustered young nun, and the Rolls purred forward on the road to Kent. Now Hansen's thoughts strayed back to his wife, dead these 10 years. It had been a happy marriage, but there'd been no children. Perhaps they should have adopted. They'd thought about it enough. His wife had been an only child, and her parents were also long dead. On his side of the family there remained his sister, whom he heartily disliked, her ghastly husband, and their equally unpleasant son. The motorway finally ran out, and Richards cut south towards unspoiled orchards, fields and woods and hop gardens. It was in this lovely countryside that Timothy Hansen had his manor house. And then there was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, of course. He'd want his share, Hansen thought, and a substantial share it would be. There was no doubt about it. One way and another, after years of delay, he was going to have to make a will. The lawyer, Mr. Pound, rose from behind his desk. "My dear Timothy, how good to see you. What can I do for you?"
"For some time now you've been urging me to make a will," Hansen said.
He reached into his attaché case and brought out a bulky manila envelope, sealed with a large blob of red wax.
"There it is, duly signed and witnessed. I know you'll wonder why I didn't ask you to prepare it, but I had my reasons."
"Of course."
"There is one last thing. In it, I've asked you to be the sole executor. But I give you my word, there is nothing that could possibly trouble your conscience, either professional or personal. Will you accept?"
"Most certainly," said the solicitor. Until September, Timothy Hansen was busy. He travelled several times to the continent, and even more frequently to the city of London. Few men who die before their time are given the opportunity to put their many and complex affairs in order, and Hansen had every intention of ensuring that his were exactly as he would wish them to be. On the 15th of September, he asked Richards to come into the house and see him.
"I have a piece of news for you," he said. "At the end of the year, I intend to retire.
I intend to spend my retirement in a much smaller residence, somewhere in the sun. I'm afraid it'll mean you're looking for another post. I shall, of course, provide the most favourable references, but I would, for business reasons, be most grateful if you wouldn't mention this in the village, or indeed to anyone at all, until it becomes necessary. You and Mrs. Richards have been good and loyal to me these past 12 years. I want you to know that I appreciate it. That envelope contains, in used and untraceable £20 notes, the sum of £10,000. On the morning of the 1st of October, Timothy Hansen came down from his bedroom after another terrible night. The pills were steadily losing their battle against the pain. He spent 10 minutes writing a short note to Richards. Then he took from his locked bureau a shotgun, loaded 2 cartridges into the breech, and retired to the library. There, he shot himself through the heart. Mr. Martin Pound took his place at the head of the long table. To his right sat Mrs. Armitage, sister of his client. Next to her, her husband. Both were dressed in black. Across the table, bored and indolent, sat their son, Tarquin. Mr. Pound addressed them. "You will understand that the late Timothy Hansen asked me to act as sole executor of his will. In the normal course of events, I would have opened it immediately upon learning of his death in order to ascertain any instructions of immediate importance." "Didn't you write it anyway?" asked Armitage Senior. "No." "So you don't know what's in it?" "No, I do not," said Pound. Without further explanation, he broke the seal on the envelope. He dealt with various formalities before he came to the disposal of his late client's estate. Having blinked, as if he had trouble reading what was in front of him, he then continued, "I give to my dear and loving sister the residue of my estate absolutely, in the confidence that she will share her good fortune with her lovable husband, Norman, and their attractive son, Tarquin. The same being subject to the conditions of paragraph 7. There was a stunned silence. The 2 male Armitages sat with open mouths. "How much was he worth?" demanded Mr. Armitage at last. "I really couldn't say," said Pound. "Come on, you must know," said the son. "You handled all his affairs."
"Almost all."
"Well?"
However unpleasant he found the Armitages, they were the sole beneficiaries of his late friend's will.
"I should have thought between 2.5 and 3 million pounds.
"Bloody hell," said Armitage Senior.
"It's a very rough estimate, you understand," said Pound helplessly.
He thought back to his friend Hansen, cultured, humorous, fastidious.
"Why, Timothy, for heaven's sake, why?"
"There is paragraph 7, he pointed out.
"What's it say?" demanded Mrs. Armitage. Pound began to read again.
"I have all my life been possessed by a great horror of one day being consumed beneath the ground by worms. I have therefore caused to be constructed a lead-lined coffin, which now reposes in the funeral parlour. It is in this that I wish to be committed to my last resting place. I direct that I shall be buried at sea, specifically 20 miles due south of the coast of Devon. Finally, I direct that my sister and brother-in-law shall, out of respect for their lifelong love for me, be the ones who dispose of my coffin in the ocean. And to my sole executor, Martin Pound, I direct that should any of these wishes not be fulfilled, then my entire estate be bequeathed to the Chancellor of the Exchequer."
Privately, Martin Pound was surprised to learn of his late friend's fears and fancies, but he gave no sign of it.
"Now, Mrs. Armitage, I have to ask you formally, do you object to the wishes of your late brother as expressed in paragraph 7?
No.
"As next of kin, will you authorize me to make the arrangements?"
Mrs. Armitage nodded abruptly.
"The sooner the better," said her husband. "Then we can get on with the probate and the inheritance."
It had taken Mr. Pound a week to make the arrangements. He'd settled on a vessel out of Brixham in Devon. The half-ton coffin stood now athwart 2 beams of timber on the wide afterdeck, waxed oak and polished brass gleaming under the autumn sky. The retired naval chaplain kept the burial service as short as decently possible, as well he might as his white hair and surplice flayed about him in the breeze. Norman Armitage was also bareheaded, looking sick as a parrot and chilled to the bone. Of Mrs. Armitage, nothing could be seen between fur hat, fur coat, and woolen scarf, save a pointed, freezing nose. Tarquin Armitage had accompanied the party as far as Brixham, but had elected to stay within the warm confines of a hostelry in town. Martin Pound stared at the sky as the priest droned on. Personally, he'd never cared about what happened to him after death, and he hadn't known that Hanson had been so concerned. With a start, he realized the service was over. The chaplain was looking at him expectantly. He nodded to the Armitages. Each placed a hand on the rear of the coffin. They gave a shove. It scraped once, then slid fast off the other end. The boat rocked, the coffin hit the side of a wave with more of a thud than a splash, and it was gone. It was almost dark when they reached Brixham and the first lights flickering in the houses behind the quay. The chaplain had his car parked nearby and was soon gone. Pound settled with the skipper.
"You'll get on with the calculation of the estate immediately," insisted Mrs. Armitage, "and the filing of probate. We've had enough of this play-acting."
"You may be confident I shall waste no time," said Pound coldly.
"I shall be in touch."
It would not, he surmised, be a long business. He knew already the extent and details of Timothy Hanson's estate. It was bound to be in perfect order. Hanson had been such a very careful man. It wasn't until mid-November that Mr. Pound, the solicitor, felt able to communicate with the Armitages again. Although, as sole beneficiary, it was only Mrs. Armitage who was invited to his office, she turned up with husband and son nonetheless.
"I find myself in something of a quandary," Mr. Pound told her.
"What about?"
"Your late brother's estate, Mrs. Armitage."
"What about it?"
"Let me explain. First, there was the rare and precious coin dealership in the city. He also owned the building in which it is situated."
"What value would all this have?" asked Armitage Senior.
"With the stock and goodwill, exactly £1.25 million.
Armitage Junior whistled through his teeth.
"How do you know so exactly?" asked Armitage.
"Because he sold it for that sum."
"He won?"
"3 months before he died, he sold the company lock, stock, and barrel. The sum paid was what I have mentioned."
"But he was working there until he died," objected Mrs. Armitage.
"Who else knew about this?" asked Mr. Armitage.
"No one," said Pound. "Not even the staff."
"So what did he do with the money?"
"He banked it."
"Well, then, no problem," said the son.
His next asset was his manor in Kent, a lovely property set in 20 acres of parkland. Last June, he took out a 95% mortgage. At the time of his death, he had only paid off one quarterly instalment. The Building Society has now taken possession of the title deeds, again perfectly legal and proper.
"How much did my brother get for it?" asked Mrs. Armitage.
£210,000.
"Which he banked?"
"Yes. He sold his apartment in Mayfair by private treaty about the same time for £150,000. This, too, was banked."
"What else?"
demanded the son.
"His private coin collection was sold piecemeal for just over £500,000 over a period of several months. He banked each sum of money following each sale. His Rolls-Royce he sold for £48,000 and leased another one instead. The leasing company has repossessed this vehicle. Finally, he had deposit accounts in various banks. His total estate, as I have been able to trace it, and I am convinced there is nothing missing, amounts to a shade over £3 million.
"You mean," said Armitage Senior, "that before he died, he called in and realized every single asset he possessed, converted it to cash and banked it, without telling a soul or raising any suspicions in those who knew him or worked for him?"
"I couldn't have put it better myself," conceded Pound.
"Well, we wouldn't have wanted all that junk anyway," said Armitage Junior. "Tot it all up, settle the debts, assess the revenue, and let's have the money."
"I'm afraid I can't."
"Why not?"
demanded Mrs. Armitage.
"He withdrew it."
"He what?"
"In cash."
You can't withdraw £3 million in cash, said Armitage Senior in disbelief.
Oh, yes, you can. Not all at once, of course, but in sums up to £50,000 from major banks with prior notice. This particular ploy has been used before, usually to avoid payment of taxes. I'm surprised at Timothy Hansen. It seldom ever works. One may withdraw a large amount of cash, but disposing of it is entirely a different matter. He must have put it somewhere, or bought something with it, and if it has been deposited, it will be traced. Apart from anything else, there are capital gains tax and estate duties payable on the sales of assets and on the estate itself. So far, I have contacted every major bank and merchant bank in the United Kingdom. I have advertised in the nation's major newspapers for information, but there has been no response. His former chauffeur and valet, Mr. Richards, cannot help. Now, the question is, what more would you wish me to do now? There was silence as the three of them pondered the issue. Privately, Martin Pound was saddened by what his friend had tried to do. How could he think to get away with it?
What do you advise? Asked Armitage.
There is always the Inland Revenue, said Pound mildly. Sooner or later, and probably sooner, I shall have to inform them of what has happened. They have all the resources of the state at their disposal.
How long would they take?
Like the mills of God, they grind slowly. They'll never call off the hunt, but they won't hurry.
We can't wait that long, said Mrs. Armitage.
What about a private detective? Suggested Armitage Junior.
It is possible. I have in the past had occasion to use a very respected one. But his services are not inexpensive. Mrs. Armitage looked at her husband.
Norman?
Armitage Senior swallowed hard, then nodded.
I'll take care of his fees.
Very well, then, said Pound. I shall engage the services of Mr. Eustace Miller, private inquiry agent.
It was 4 weeks before Miller reported his progress to date. Pound was by this time almost as curious as the Armitages, so he arranged a meeting at his office.
I began this inquiry, Miller said, surveying them all in turn, with three assumptions in mind. One was that the late Mr. Hansen had gone through his extraordinary performance in the months before he died with complete deliberation and a firm purpose. Secondly, I believe that Mr. Hansen's purpose was to deny his apparent inheritors and the commissioners of Inland Revenue any access to his fortune after his death. Thirdly, I presumed that Mr. Hansen had neither burned the money nor undertaken the considerable risks of trying to smuggle it abroad. In short, I came to the view he had bought something with it, and after extensive inquiries, I consulted a dealer in precious metals, and I found it.
The money?
Chorused the three Armitages together.
The answer, said Miller. 250... 50-ounce ingots of high-grade 99.95% pure platinum.
There was a stunned silence.
It wasn't, frankly, a very clever ruse, said Mr. Miller with some regret. The buyer may have destroyed all record of his purchases, but obviously the vendor wouldn't destroy his records of the sales. And here they are.
How much did he spend?
Nigh on the whole, £3 million, said Miller. 250 ingots, each of 50 fine ounces weight.
Where did he take them all? Armitage Senior demanded.
To his manor in Kent. Mr. Hansen had an extremely well-equipped carpentry workshop in a former barn behind the stables. Last May, he bought a powerful diesel-fueled electric generator and installed it there to operate a small and very efficient furnace. Both have long gone. But between two floorboards, jammed out of sight and covered by compacted sawdust, I discovered this.
From his case, he took a thin sliver of congealed metal that glittered in the light.
It is high-grade 99.95% platinum.
But it has one property that he must have underestimated and which is quite unique. Its weight.
Now at least we know what we're looking for. A wooden crate of some kind, apparently innocent to look at, but, and this is the point, weighing just under half a ton.
Mrs. Armitage threw back her head and uttered a strange, raucous cry like a wounded animal. Mr. Armitage dropped his head forward into his hands. Martin Pound stared unbelievingly at the private investigator.
"Good Lord," he said.
"Oh, my goodness me. He actually took it with him." The scrap metal dealer walked happily towards his bank, confident he would get there just before they closed for the Christmas holiday. The reason for his pleasure was tucked inside his breast pocket, a check for a substantial sum, the last of a series of such checks that over the past few months had ensured him a much higher income than he'd ever managed to earn in 20 years. He'd had no difficulty in understanding the silver-haired investor who called himself Richards and had a driving license to prove it. To have sold the 50-ounce platinum ingots on the open market would beyond doubt have secured him a higher price. But at what cost in capital gains tax? The dealer was blissfully unaware that in other parts of Britain, another four, like himself, had also spent the autumn filtering 50 ingots each back into the market through the second-hand trade, having bought them for cash from a silver-haired man who called himself Richards. On that same Christmas Eve, a solicitor from Guernsey peered up at the building in the Old Kent Road where the taxi had dropped him. 10 minutes later, he was closeted with a somewhat mystified Mother Superior.
"May I ask, Mother Superior, whether St. Benedict's Orphanage qualifies as a registered charity?"
Yes, it does."
"Good. Then no infringement has taken place, and there will be no application in your case of the capital transfer tax. I am happy to tell you that a donor, whose identity I can't reveal, has seen fit to donate a substantial sum to your establishment. My client instructed me to present myself to you on this day and give you this envelope. I understand it contains a certified bank check made out in favour of St. Benedict's Orphanage."
No gift tax?" The nun was staring at him in bewilderment.
"That is correct. In the Channel Islands, we have a different fiscal system. A donation within Guernsey or the islands attracts no tax, although if the recipient is domiciled or resident within the UK mainland, then he or she would be liable under mainland tax law, unless already exempted, such as by the Charities Act, as you are. And now, if you will sign a receipt, I will have discharged my duty."
2 minutes later, the Mother Superior was alone. Slowly, she extracted the contents of the envelope. It was a single, certified check for over £2.5 million. There was enough to endow the orphanage forever. Certainly enough to fulfil the ambition of a lifetime. To get the orphanage out of the slums of London and establish it in the fresh air of the open countryside. She could...
Now, what was it? Yes, that was it. The Sunday newspaper, the week before last. Something had caught her eye. An advertisement in the property columns. That was it. That was where they would go. It had said, "For sale, a manor house in Kent, with 20 acres of parkland."